Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is Sean Sublett. He is a meteorologist with Climate Central out of Princeton, New Jersey. And he's here to talk about, well, some of the things we mentioned in the intro, the fact that June is was the third warmest June on record, globally speaking. And we'll get a sense of maybe what that means to the U.S. And also how 2020 is faring so far as global warming goes. Sean, thanks so much for joining Nell and myself this morning on This Green Earth.
Got it. Good morning.
Sean, thank you.
How are you?
Time's the charm.
Sorry about that little technical glitch there, but you sound great. And we're going to, like I said, I don't know if you heard the intro, but we're going to talk about, well, the report that NOAA put out that suggests that 2020 is right now on its way to be the second warmest year since record keeping started globally, and has a possibility of perhaps being the warmest year on record. We'll get to that eventually. I wanted to start with June, though. Let's just start with June and expand out. June was the third warmest June on record planet-wise, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And how much warmer are we talking?
Well, but you know, it depends on what part of the globe you're looking at. But in general, you're looking at about a degree or two above normal Celsius, which is more in the lines of 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes.
And again, that doesn't sound like an awful lot, but when you average that over the entire globe, that's a tremendous amount of energy. You know, 1 degree here, 1 degree there, you sum that up over the entire world, and you've done some serious heating.
Yeah, because that's usually the kind of the response I get from some people who say, oh, it's a degree, and we always talk Fahrenheit here. It's two and a half degrees. What's the big deal? Because, seasons during the course of a year, temperatures vary widely. And so what is 1 or 1.5 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit? And you're saying that's a lot of energy being absorbed by the planet and radiated out by the planet.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot more than it sounds. I mean, if you think about just an average July day, let's say your average temperature is 82, 83, and then your average temperature is now 84 or 85. Again, not that big of a deal, but you think about, the average July 21st, you're going to have some July 21st that are a lot hotter than average, and a few July 21st that are cooler than average. So if you've bumped your average up, those times that are a lot above average are going to be a lot hotter than you've experienced in the past. So the kinds of numbers that, you might get once every 20 or 30 years in terms of extreme heat might start happening once every 5 or 10 years. So by nudging up the average temperature, you disproportionately increase the amount of extremely high temperatures. So that's the issue there. And especially for people who spend a lot of time outside, for people who may not have air conditioning when it gets especially hot, that really adds up.
Yes.
Are we also seeing differences or disproportionate difference in daytime, temps versus nighttime temps with this warming?
In general, we see the warming signal more defined at night than the day. Both days and nights are warming, but there's a little more warming taking place at night, which is very consistent with what we understand about how the atmosphere works. If you've got, two ways to control the temperature. You've got the incoming solar energy, and then you've got what we call the terrestrial infrared, or basically the greenhouse gas. All right, so the solar plus the greenhouse gases are adding to the temperature. So what happens at night? You turn off the sun, all right, so you still have the greenhouse gases helping to keep things warm in the middle of the night. And so we're seeing a bigger increase at night, which tells us that that particular component of the temperature equation, if you will, the greenhouse gases, is more important than we might have originally thought. We're seeing that signal more at night than during the day. Again, warming in day at night, but warming even more at night, suggesting that greenhouse gases are even more important.
When you're talking about temperature, you're talking about both what I consider land-based temperatures and ocean temperatures. temperatures.
Correct.
Right? But the land-based temperature obviously is atmospheric, right? So it's a thermometer that's taking the temperature of the air over the land. Is there an average height that all these thermometers are collecting temperatures at?
Generally, it's about 10 feet above the ground.
Oh.
That's the ideal. When you're looking at land-based thermometers, again, you can't control where every individual and every country and every single site that a temperature is taken. But ideally, you like it about 10 feet above the ground. So you're not too close to the ground, but you're not too high up. Because, you know, I mean, sand, it gets very, very hot.
Mm, right.
So if you try to take the temperature one inch above the sand, that's going to be a lot hotter than 10 feet up. So you want to get a good representation of what the air is like and not what the air is like immediately above very hot sand or immediately above, the Great Salt Lake, for that matter.
Right. So,
but back to the temperature issue you mentioned before, real quick, the NOAA report said, that's the average land and ocean temperature. And it takes a lot more energy to raise the temperature of water than it does to raise the temperature of land. And, we've also seen the average ocean temperature up about a degree or two over the past 100 years. And that takes even more energy than just heating up the land. In fact, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know is that the additional energy from the greenhouse warming, 90% of that is actually going into the oceans. And the oceans, are a huge storehouse of energy.
Wow.
So, and then in time, that evaporates back into the atmosphere. You've warmed the oceans, so you're going to get more evaporation off of a warmer ocean. Just like you have a warmer glass of water, it evaporates more than a cold glass of water. And that's going to raise the temperature and give you more precipitation and the like. So, it's land and ocean.
And ocean, again, that is actually the temperature of the water that you're talking about, not the air surface immediately above the water. But there you're actually taking temperatures of the water itself and then combining that with the temperatures of the air 10 feet plus or minus on land. And that's how you get a global temperature.
That's correct. And there are hundreds of sites, if not thousands of sites, buoys and the like, taking sea surface temperatures. And we also get good water temperature data from satellites, from remote sensing. We corroborate those things, calibrate them to be sure they're accurate. Because measuring the water temperature across the world is challenging to be sure. But we've gotten a pretty good handle over it, especially the last 20 or 25 years.
When we're talking about the ocean temperatures, how deep are those thermometers how are they managed? Like, are these out in remote parts of the ocean and they're sending data back? How are they maintained? I'm interested to see what an ocean thermometer looks like.
Yeah, a lot of these are on something called Argo floats. And a lot of these have been deployed in the Southern Ocean. Basically, they'll go to a certain depth. They have a pressure sensor, and then they'll go back up toward the surface and measure what the temperature of the water is as it travels up and down. And there are just hundreds of these floats scattered across the ocean. Some are in very remote locations, some are in not so remote locations, in the middle of the Pacific or Hawaii or the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic, and again, the Southern Ocean, all those places. And those are what we call in situ measurements. We actually have a thermometer right there measuring. But then we calibrate that with our satellites. The satellite will look at and see what the energy is coming off of the ocean, do a calculation, calibrate that with the actual thermometer in the water, and gives us a good idea of what the sea surface temperature is. And most of this goes down to about 700 meters, so you think about 1,500 feet. That's the part of the atmosphere, part of the ocean that is relatively well mixed. But there is also evidence that some of the much deeper water that's going down a mile or so is also beginning to warm. Some of that warmth is beginning to get deeper into the ocean.
Wow. And is that just like convective heating or can be influenced by current, deep water currents that are dropping down?
Deep water currents is exactly it. Yeah, because there's a big, it's called, in science we have big words. It's called the thermohaline circulation.
Right.
But there's a big ocean conveyor that takes surface water toward the North Atlantic, and it drops deeper into the Atlantic Ocean, runs southward, and then kind of hooks back north of Antarctica into the Indian Ocean. So there's a big, big ocean circulation. It's very slow, because you're moving so much water, but the ocean is cycling. It's not static.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Sean Sublett. He's a meteorologist with the group Climate Central. They're out of Princeton, New Jersey. Sean, give us a minute sketch or so of what Climate Central is about.
Yeah, you know, we've been around for about 10 or 11 years, and we're just a nonprofit organization of meteorologists or climate scientists. We have some sea level scientists. We have some graphic artists, data analysts. And our job is to essentially communicate the science and impacts of climate change to the public. We're a nonprofit. We're also nonpartisan. All we talk about is science. We're not going to get into policy. We'll talk about options, but we're not here to advocate for any one particular solution or policy. We're just trying to get the science out there as accurately as we possibly can.
Good.
Well, Climate Central is always a great resource for just that, as you say, for the science, for the facts.
You love it.
One piece of information that caught my eye is that June was the 44th consecutive June and the 426th consecutive month with temperatures above average. I don't know. We'll have to do the math real quick. How many years ago is that we had a month below average? And how much higher are these, Junes above the previous June?
I think it was, and I don't have the figure right off the top of my head, but I think it was in the 80s that we had a month that was globally below average. And, we've got to be careful where you draw your average. In this case, NOAA uses the average temperature for the 20th century. So when we talk about the 20th century average from, 1901 to 2000.
Okay.
I would not expect the temperature to be below average globally again in our lifetimes unless, frankly, there's a massive volcanic eruption somewhere. I think that's what, this just being an earth scientist, and I'm trying to think of how, given the increase in greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere, and again, this is the burning of fossil fuels. You said carbon on fire, you get carbon dioxide, and it stays up there in the atmosphere. There's no easy way to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That's part of the issue. So as long as that's going, there's no reason to expect, without some kind of external influence, that the temperatures are ever going to be below the 20th century average again.
But they're also above, on a fairly consistent basis, the 30-year average, because occasionally we would have someone on from the local office of the National Weather Service, and they work in 30-year averages. And, these temperatures are above 30-year average, too, correct?
Yeah. In operational meteorology, which I did for about 20 years, we follow the NOAA, or it's called the NCEI, National Centers for Environmental Information. They're 30-year averages, which is basically, it's called the 30-year normals. We take the averages and we kind of smooth them out, or they smooth them out. That gives you a climate normal for the last 30 years, and that changes every 10 years. After every 10 years, the numbers are recalculated. So right now, when we talk about a climate normal, when the folks at the Weather Service or local media talk about the climate normal, they're looking at the smooth average from 1981 to 2010, that 30-year period.
I remember the first time that we kind of learned this and, a million years ago, talking with these meteorologists, and they were saying, when we talk about this average, it is this rolling 30-year average. So if you look at how that's changed over a longer time period, the differences are even bigger. And I think that's noteworthy as a consumer of the weather, reports to note that.
Yeah. I mean, if you look and, I just pulled up a graphic from NOAA for the average temperature for the year in Utah, going back to 1895. In 1895, the average temperature in Utah for the year was 46.5 degrees.
Uh-huh.
All right. Now it's 49 degrees.
Wow.
So, you're up 2.5 degrees since 1895. And again, you're always going to have some hotter years. You're going to have some cooler years. But if, you go those ups and downs, you kind of smoothly fit a line to that data. You see, generally, it's up about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 120, 125 years.
And so we're going to recalculate that 30-year average at the end of this year. So we'll have a new 30-year average from 1991 to 2020, correct?
Correct. That's absolutely correct.
And that average is going to go up, that baseline.
Correct. Correct once again.
So, all right.
I'll talk it out.
All right,
it out.
Here's the third one. If that average, 30-year average, is going to go up, that's our new baseline. Our comparison is going to be, on a year-over-year basis, is going to be with a higher 30-year average. So you could actually see lower increments, you know, lower increases. You see what I'm... On a year-over-year basis, you could be comparing warmer years to a warmer average, and people will say, see, we're only 1 degree warmer.
Right, and that's why it's very important when you start throwing out terms like normal or average. You quantify what you're talking about.
Yes.
You know, that's why it's very important when we say, when we get this NOAA report, oh, it's X amount of degrees warmer than average. Well, when do we take our average?
Yes.
And in NOAA's case, it's for the full 20th century. All right, so when this report comes out, it's the full 20th century. For people doing regular everyday weather forecasting, which is a different group of folks, you know, they're looking at the last 30 years. You know, and these are conventions that have been locked into meteorology and oceanography and atmospheric science for a long, long time. And that's another conversation entirely. about if you want to do that, because, you know, people will always ask, well, why did you set your average this way? Or why did you set your normal this way? Why did you do it this way? So you want to be as transparent and as open about your data as much as possible. You want to have as much data as you can for fair comparison purposes. That's why I said, since 1895 in Utah, which is as far back as the reliable records go, you know, the average annual temperature for the BI states up 2.5 degrees.
Right.
All right. So with that in mind, here's another long-term question. So as you look at the big picture and you look at how the temperature has been increasing since 1880, when we started keeping these records, has the rate of change also been changing? So is the increase happening faster now than it was then?
Yes, it has begun to accelerate. When we look at, you know, the rate of increase in the greenhouse gases that is starting to show up more now in the temperature record, in particularly the last 10 to 15 years, but in some aspects back to the 1970s, if you look at, and again, I'll be happy to share any graphics with y'all later on. I know this is radio, but so work with me here for a second.
Sure.
Imagine two lines that are kind of parallel. They're going in the same direction. They're both going up, starting back at the end of the 19th century. One of them is the average global temperature every year, and the other one is how strong the sun is. It's sometimes called the solar cycle. And both of those things are going in about the same direction until about 1970. Then in 1970, we started to see the temperature spiking up even further, while that line that shows the solar output or the solar strength flatten out or even drop a little bit. So while there was certainly some contributor to global warming from greenhouse gas emissions in the first half of the 20th century, the last quarter of the 20th century, and now into the 21st century, that impact has been magnified. It's a lot more drawn out. And, you know, the longer we add the greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the more we can expect this to go on.
So if I understand it right, say I was looking at the latest CO2 charts, and right now, as of today, we can actually, I predict in the future, we'll probably be reporting that on a daily basis, what the CO2 concentration is. As of today, it's 414 parts per million. Back when Nell and I started the show, we always like to say back in 2006, 2007, it was around 380. So it's gone from 380 to 414. I guess we're not doing a very good job now trying to do our part.
We got to get louder.
But that increase used to be like 1 part per million or 1.5 part per million per year in the 90s, early to. Now it seems to be increasing at 2 to almost occasionally 3 parts per million per year. So that increase is increasing.
Yeah, the rate of change is going up.
Rate of change.
You know, and part of this is, you know, we've got a bigger global population than 50 or 60 years ago. There's more demand for energy. More of the world is developing closer to a standard of living that's close to Western Europe and the United States. So the demands for energy continue to go up. So since a lot of energy is carbon-based, fossil-based. You know, you're burning more carbon, you're putting more CO2 into the atmosphere. And until we find a way to get our energy needs a different way that avoids setting carbon on fire, this is going to continue to be an issue. I mean, there are certainly some places that are making progress regarding wind and solar. West Texas has done a lot with wind, for example. A lot of California has done a lot with solar. So we're seeing some changes. The question is, you know, how fast will these changes take place? And that's, you know, that's the $64,000 question. Mm.
There was a headline that I saw quite a bit that definitely caught my eye, which was a potential new maximum temperature north of the Arctic Circle. Mm. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Can you fill us in?
Yeah, I think it was 100.4 degrees in northern Siberia a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, north of the Arctic Circle. You know, part of the reason for that is that the Arctic sea ice extent or area continues to dwindle from year to year. Again, it's a maximum in the winter, of course. It's a minimum in the summer, of course. But in the long-term mean, it is going down. So you don't have as much Arctic ice nearby. So you've got open water. And the other thing sometimes people forget, I mean, it's obvious in the wintertime, especially in a place like Park City, when the sun is out and there's snow on the ground, it's very reflective and you need your sunglasses. Same thing with sea ice. It reflects an awful lot of solar energy, right? But when that ice is gone and you've got dark ocean water, that absorbs energy. So you're bringing more solar energy into the local environment than you had before. On top of the regular weather patterns, you know, maybe it would have gotten a 92 or 93, but now you've added a little bit extra by removing the ice nearby. And so that's going to get you an extra 5 or 6 degrees. It's like we said before, oh, it's only a degree or two or 2 or 3 degrees in the average. Well, this is where this shows back up. Now you're going to get that extra 2 or 3 degrees on those extreme hot days. Those extreme hot days now are reaching levels that you have never seen before. You know, it's just 3 or 4 degrees hotter than it's been in the history of human civilization.
Right.
It's almost, you know, like, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I mean, yes, it's been obviously hotter in Earth's distant past.
Yes.
You know, hundreds of thousands to millions of years ago. But none of us were around. There were no cities. There were no coastal cities. There's no agriculture. You know, we've kind of have built our global society over the last 150 years on a reasonably stable climate. Again, climate is always changing. We know that. But the fact that it's always changed in the past is how we know it can be changed today and in the future.
We're speaking with Sean Sublett. He's a meteorologist with the group Climate Central out of Princeton, New Jersey. Sean, I know we're running a little long. I hope, do you have a few more minutes? Because we have a few more questions.
Sure, yeah, that's fine.
Beautiful. So the oceans, you know, the ice loss, sea ice loss up there is influencing these temperatures, record temperatures in Siberia. Is there weather patterns that are also being created as a result of this sea ice loss?
There's a lot of work being done on exactly that topic. There's some pretty compelling evidence to suggest that decrease in ice in the Arctic has repercussions on jet stream flow, which is what on any given day is a larger governor of your temperature. You know, is your jet stream bringing in hot air from the south? Is it bringing in cold air from the north? I mean, that's going to affect your weather from day to day to day. All right. So it lends itself to the idea that there could be more extremes, but your extreme cold will not be as cold as it's been in the past. Your extreme heat will be hotter than it's been in the past. So there's still, you know, you want to look for a place where there's debate and discussion in the science, and that is the place. How much of an impact will less ice in the Arctic play on global weather patterns?
Right.
Okay, it is certainly going to play a role. The quantification or the extent of that is still being worked through. And look, there are a few scientists who are just absolutely, like, it's very compelling, and they're convinced. You know, and there are a few who are like, well, I think so, but we still need a little more work to look at this. Did you look at this yet? We haven't had enough data yet. So it's not a question of if it's happening. The question is the extent and what are the ultimate impacts going to be? You know, are the weather patterns going to change enough?
Yes. And obviously, any changes in jet stream patterns and magnitudes and dips and things influences our weather here in North America. You know, it influences all the weather in the Northern Hemisphere, basically. Okay, I wanted to circle back because originally we wanted to talk about 2019. So far, you know, June was the third warmest. But so far, 2019 is on track to be the second warmest year on a global basis, that only exceeded by the year 2016. Is that right?
Yeah, it'd be 2019 or 2020?
Oh,
current year, 2020.
Did I say 2019?
Sometimes I prefer to forget 2020 is even happening.
Right. We'll rewind the clock a little bit.
Yes.
All right.
So far this year,
2020 is the second warmest. It's on track to be the second warmest because not only June has been warm, but you can go back May, April, March. They probably were all in the top five or so. They're doing their best.
When you look at the first 6 months of the year, yeah, it's the second hottest.
And then it's the report suggests that there's a 35% chance that 2020 could be the warmest year on record. One in three. It's up there. It's trending in that direction.
Yeah.
So now when you look at the top 10 years, Sean, remember the good old days when 1998 was the warmest year on record?
I remember those days, yes.
And even through 2005 and 2006, it was like, oh, well, 1998 was the warmest year on record. So you see things are cooling since then. That was always kind of the suggestion. But now 1998, I don't even think it makes the top 10. It's gone. Okay.
In the last 20 years, 10 of the, when we look at the top 10 hottest years, they've all been since the turn of the century.
Okay.
So I think 1998 has now dropped to 11th place.
Yes.
It'll be a 10th, 11th, 12th. It's somewhere in there right now. Again, I don't have the precise figure right on top of me, but off the top of my head is 10, 11, 12, somewhere like that. And one of the things about this year and comparing to 2016, you know, right now we're only behind 2016. This time in 2016, we were coming out of a raging El Nino. You know, and for those who don't know, an El Nino is a periodic warming of the central and eastern Pacific Ocean right along the equator. And this goes back to what we talked about before, ocean currents. They change, they shift a little bit. So every off and on, every 4, 5, 6 years, you get this periodic warming of the central and eastern part of the Pacific Ocean, right? And that releases more heat into the atmosphere, which is why 16 was the hottest year. We don't have that right now, and it's still the second hottest so far this year. In fact, the ocean in that part of the Pacific Ocean, the central and eastern part of the Pacific near the equator is close to average or even a little cooler than average. And there are signs that there's a very modest cooling going on there for the second half of the year. I mean, modest cooling. This isn't like, oh, wow, look at the big. No. They're very minor. So my guess, my professional guess, is that we will probably come in second or third for the year in terms of hottest years on record. However, having said that, depending on what happens here in the Arctic, because the Arctic sea ice right now, is the lowest for this time of year since satellite records began in 1979. Again, that's not an awfully long time, but 79 is when we started getting good satellite records of the extent of Arctic ice, sea ice. And right now because they can measure it every day with the satellites up there. And for July 21st, it is the lowest July 21st on record.
Wow.
In terms of the extent. So if that continues to trend downward, again, that also sends more energy into the atmosphere. So that's the big storehouse of heat is the ocean, whether it's the Arctic or the Pacific or any of those places. Right? Water is a tremendous storehouse of energy. So my guess is we're second or third by the end of this year. But I would not be surprised if it does end up the hottest year on record. It would not surprise me. And again, we're kind of splitting hairs here.
Yeah.
Whether it's first or second or third,
right.
It's still one of the top three in 120 plus years of records. So it's hot, y'all.
Yeah.
In summary.
It is.
Yes.
So you kind of just touched on, with your comments about El Nino, what I was going to ask, which is like, okay, with this relatively smooth increase in CO2 in the atmosphere, why are the temperatures not kind of rising in an exact correlation with that? Like, what are the external factors that are impacting the temperature? Or is it maybe just a mistake in the way that we're measuring? You know, we just don't have...
No, they're always, as they drilled into me as an undergrad, there are always variations around the mean, all right? So you're always going to have hot spells, cool spells, not just locally, but globally. There will be a few external forces that will make this year a little hotter than a different year. Like I said before, the El Nino in 16 kind of bumped that up to the tippy top. The warming is taking place. It's like... The El Nino is like putting a cherry on top of the ice cream. It's just a little bit more. But back to the original part of the question, why have we not seen the warming more rapidly? It takes a while for the planet to come into balance, a temperature kind of balance. Mm-hmm. For example, if we think about the first day of summer, June 21st, that's not the hottest day of the year. You know, typically the hottest day of the year is well into the summer.
Right.
So even though the sun is at its highest in the sky at the end of June, it's hottest in July because there's still more incoming energy than is going out, even though the sun isn't as high. So the thermal lag or the temperature lag is a few weeks from the first day of summer into midsummer, even though the sun isn't as high in the sky. For the same reason, the hottest part of the day isn't noon. You know, the hottest part of the day is typically 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
There's a delay. There's a lag. Same thing with the carbon dioxide effect here, right? There's a little bit of a lag, and we keep putting CO2 into the atmosphere. Even if we were to shut it off immediately and put no more CO2 in the atmosphere, we would still expect the temperature to go up another 10 or 20 years at this pace before it leveled off.
Wow. And that,
all right.
Yeah, I just want to say, with the pandemic, you know, we came as close to shutting things off as you could get as a planet. And it is an interesting unintended consequence of the pandemic that I'm sure scientists are interested to see if there's any influence of all the fossil fuels that were not burned during the months of March, maybe April, May, somewhat June. Is it too early to tell if that's had any influence on atmospheric temperature or atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide?
Sure. Well, you know, the CO2 measurements are done daily.
Yeah.
I mean, daily at several key spots across the globe, including Mauna Loa in Hawaii. That's the most longstanding record, which goes back to the 50s. And it's done there to be away from cities, to get a good representation of what CO2 levels are like planet-wide, because you're away from human influences. Out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And even though people didn't drive as much and there weren't as many factories running, people were still in the winter having to heat their homes. So there was still CO2 being generated,
yeah.
Not at the level that we would otherwise have. The biggest drop was in nitrogen dioxide, which isn't as relevant in terms of the greenhouse gas. The concentration is even lower. That settles out pretty fast. Mm. So the effect, unfortunately, I guess we could say unfortunately, has been negligible regarding CO2. When you look at the concentrations on the daily basis, it's been negligible. Now, you might say, well, they went down a little bit this summer, but they do go down every summer a little bit, a few parts per million. They go down every summer because in the northern hemisphere where most of the land is, in the summer you've got the trees,
right,
and the grasses thriving because it's summer. So they are taking in a little more CO2. So the amount in the atmosphere dips a tiny bit. But then in the fall, when all that stuff dies off, the CO2 jumps back up. So you kind of have like the sawtooth pattern in
right.
the CO2. So it goes, but each subsequent year, it's higher than the previous. So it's kind of a sawtooth graph that is going up. So don't be, oh, well, if you look, oh, it fell a little bit in May and June.
Right.
Don't get all excited about that, because I tell you what, when October gets here, you're going to see that number jump.
You're dashing our hopes.
Well, if
well, I mean, it's just historically, we've seen it every year. And when you look at the data right now, there's no reason to expect otherwise, unfortunately.
Sure.
Well, I find it ironic that that town in Russia had a temperature of 100.4 degrees because that's the temperature that we use to check ourselves when we like go into a building or an activity, right? So if that town had a temperature, it would be told to go home and lay down for a while. And unfortunately,
right.
14 days quarantine.
I think the planet is also on its way. And unfortunately, we are the virus of this.
One of the terms we heard is that the planet has a fever. You know, if your temperature was up 2 or 3 degrees above normal, you'd stay home.
Yeah.
And, you know, the planet is up 2 or 3 degrees above the long-term average, you know, so it kind of has a fever.
Yeah, it has a fever, and we might be the virus of that.
So, you know, all right. We're going to have to decide how we want to handle it as people living on this planet.
We'll leave it at that, but I will let you know, Sean, that next week we are going to talk to a scientist from the National Snow and Ice Data Center to get a little more detail about that Arctic sea ice, because that is really disturbing what's going on there. And like you say, it's on a record path itself as far as sea ice coverage. So we'll continue this.
They do really good work there at NSIDC.
Yes, and so we're going to check in with them. But Sean Sublett, meteorologist with the nonprofit Climate Central out of Princeton, New Jersey. Thanks again for taking the time to chat with us and answer all our questions. We really appreciate it. And
thanks, Chris. Happy to help out anytime.
We will be back in touch to get an update on how 2020